these old people have so little in their lives, just sitting in hospital all the time. So, so it was even though it was just 2 years, it was a major part of my life. It was a big adventure for me. So I.
Were it 2 years constantly, or?
Two winters, two consecutive winters. The Bransfield was late in being commissioned, so we set sail, I think it was the 3rd or 4th of January. And then I got to base just before my 23rd birthday. And I stayed for a year at Argentine Islands, which is now Faraday. And then I went down to Adelaide, which is now closed down. They're on the other side of Adelaide Island at Rothera now. And I spent a winter there, and also 2 or 3 months down at Fossil Bluff, and travelling around.
How did you get involved with the expedition?
With the British Antarctic Survey? For as long as I can remember, I always wanted to have do something adventurous like that. And then one of my subjects I studied at university was geography. And I went on an expedition to Greenland in 1968, which was studying physical geography. And the leader of that expedition, a professor, he had been in the Antarctic. He's still going down to the Antarctic now. He's a professor in Edinburgh. Forget his name, David Sugden. David Sugden and Chalmers Clapperton. And they're still going down to the Antarctic, and he suggested I go. He proposed my name, gave me the address to write to. And also the British Antarctic Survey recruiting men used to come around the universities recruiting people. So I just applied for a job. It seemed like an adventurous thing to do after university. So I applied for it, and I spent 2 winters down there.
And also, you already had been to Greenland.
I had already been to Greenland, yes, So it gave me a taste for expedition life, and I enjoyed it. And I hope, obviously, David Sugden must have given me a good reference, because I was accepted for it.
And you already had an idea of what it was like?
I already had when they come round, it was Bill Sloman, who was a recruiting officer in those days, and he gave you a lecture and told you what it was like down there. And of course I'd read some books about life in the Antarctic, you know. So I had a rough idea what it was like. It didn't correspond to reality at all.
No? How was this first time?
The first time when I saw the first base, Argentine Islands, from the ship, I thought, my goodness, it was grey, it was dreary, drab. All these seemingly dirty men, you know, very, very rugged looking, very hard looking men. I thought, my goodness, oh. You know. But after a while, it was home. You know? I was amazed at the squalor and how they're living cheek by jowl with each other all the time. You know, cheek by jowl.
Yeah, but can you explain?
Cheek by jowl, in such close proximity to each other, but after a while you just get used to it and you never think anything of it. I remember looking and thinking, Jesus Christ, I've got to spend 2 years there, or a year there, you know. But you got used to it in no time flat and you settled in. My first year, it was a lot different from my second year. Second year you felt more responsible. First year, it was a lot of just settling into base, finding the correct things to do all the time to keep yourself busy. You know, besides amusing things, there's a lot of base chores, a lot of base duties. In the second year, I found myself far more attuned to things that require doing around base. And basically, something like that, the busier you keep yourself, the quicker time passes. But the first year at Argentine Islands, it was an archipelago of islands, and there's a lot to be done, boating, skiing. We had dogs there, did a bit of sledging, plenty to occupy yourself. photography. Whereas at Adelaide, it was just a big Piedmont glacier. We couldn't go sailing or anything like that. Skiing was just limited to up to the airstrip and back down again. We did a certain amount of sledging, but none of us were really experienced in it. I was in charge of the dogs in my second year, and I reared some pups. I looked after the sledges. I kept myself occupied that way. You probably heard already. In midwinter, we produced a midwinter magazine, and I involved myself in that. Just you're far more experienced in your second year to keep yourself occupied. Yeah. And the work could just roll along.
Those men who looked so worn down and filthy,
rugged.
Mm-hmm. Rugged. So,
mm-hmm.
What were they like to you in those first times? Because your impression of them changed.
When I first saw them, I thought they looked very, I'd say, real hard men. You know, they looked men, whereas I felt I was just a callow youth coming from practically straight from university, and all very slack jawed and taken in by it all. They seemed men, and I felt like just a youth, you know. But gradually, you just fitted into it yourself. And
slack-jawed,
aye. Slack-jawed, just
yeah.
Astonished by it all, you know. It's the same with any strangers. You're always a bit in awe of any strangers coming from anywhere, you know. You think they're far superior people to you and far more adult or whatever, you know. Because it was my 23rd birthday when I just after I arrived on the first base at Argentine Island, so I was still very young, you know.
What was the average age?
Well, say the early 20s, you know, 23, 24. We had one man there who was 40, and he was on secondment from the Royal Electrical and Mechanical Engineers, and he was, I mean, we could always let the young men, you could always let your hair down, you know, by getting drunk and doing stupid things, but he was a bit too, he'd been down before, he's a bit too rigid about things.
Did he fit in?
I mean, he got on okay with other people, but he didn't really fit in, not the same as everyone else. There was always one. I think one of the main criterion for choosing people down there was that they chose people who could fit in with other people, you know, who could gel with other people, jive with other people. But they always seemed to choose, whether it was deliberate or just accidental, there was always somebody that didn't, you know, one loner. And everyone else would sit and talk about him. Rather than all fighting amongst themselves, you'd all sit and talk about this one particular person. And this one man, as I said, he was an arch conservative. He'd been down there before. He was 40 years old, which was ancient in those days. Yeah, because most people, you know, they go down to the Antarctic for a few years, a couple of years, before they settle down to married life or whatever. So this man was out of kilter with the rest of us.
It was also the 1970s, so it was also the time of, you know, don't trust anyone above 30.
Well, that's true of anyone that's in your early 20s, you know. Uh-huh.
Did you go on sledging tours?
I was mainly on the base, but we went on one or two sledging tours. Just for the fun of it, but we were very inexperienced with no one to really help us. In Argentine Islands, we were stuck in this archipelago of islands, and we didn't get any sea ice that year, so we couldn't go any very far. But went one or two short ones in Adelaide Island, but you know, nobody had any experience of sledging and staying out in those conditions, so we didn't go very far.
But did you camp?
We camped, yes. We camped on the ice, and once, just outside base, I found an overhanging wall of snow that there was and I excavated a cave there, and I spent a night in the snow cave. You know, just for a laugh, just for something different, you know. It was quite an experience. And at Argentine Islands, we had an old base dating from the 1930s, 1940s, Operation Tabarin, I think it was. And it was about a couple of miles from the Argentine Islands base. We used to go down there for holidays, maybe two of you together, and stay there for a while. And change something, get away from base, you know. It was just a novelty.
For the sake of it.
Just a change of kitchen sink, I suppose, you know, just different things. Just the secret was just to keep yourself occupied, whether it was work or play or whatever, keep yourself occupied in plenty of things, and rather than sitting around getting morose. We had a very good time.
How many days were you on the sledging tours?
As I said, only about 3 or 4 very short periods of time, you know. Or maybe 5 days, something like that. Just because we didn't have the experience and the dogs were... All the teams had different names. There were at Stonington, which they made sledging base, they had the Huns and the Comats and the Picts. And at Adelaide Island, where the dogs were mainly kept for breeding purposes and for recreation, we had the Mighty Rabble. And, they were absolutely terrible. I mean, we had no sledging experience, and the Mighty Rabble, there were 8 bitches and 1 dog. And the bitches, once they started fighting, that was that, you know. They were terrible for fighting. And the one dog would be fighting to get away from the bitches. So... That was more or less that, you know.
How did you learn to drive the dog team?
Just by seeing other men doing it and listening to other men and then experimenting yourself and making numerous mistakes.
Is it so easy?
When you're setting away from base, the dogs are particularly excited. They're really excited, so they're really prone to fighting. Then if anything goes wrong, the dogs will start fighting right away. They won't attack human beings, but they fight with each other. But once you've had them out for 2 or 3 days and they'll settle down, they get more tired and they're more obedient then. But we were also held back at Adelaide Island because we hadn't a proper lead dog. Princess, the lead bitch that we had, she was getting a bit old and she wasn't strong enough to lead the dogs. But we used to take the dogs ski-joring. We'd get them to tow us 2 dogs or maybe even 3, but mainly 2 dogs. They'd tow you along in a pair of skis. You used to have good fun that way. And you could also take 3 or 4 dogs out in the creeks in Argentine Islands and just a light sledge and the dogs, you know. It was good fun.
Did you ever get into a situation that you couldn't go further because the weather deteriorated? A lie-up day?
Steve Valance, who was the doctor, he and I went out once sledging, and I spanned out the dogs at night. I tied down the sledge. It was these pyramid tents. Without a sewn-in ground sheet, a pyramid tent, and it was a glorious evening. And just before I went to bed, I tied everything up. I thought, I may as well be conscientious. I don't know why I'm doing this, but I tied everything up. I lashed everything down. And during the night, a blizzard blew up, and we were lying there for 3 or 4 days in this. It was a really terrible blizzard. We'd dangle the rope from the apex of the tent down in between us, and we had a a ski under our mattresses, just a single ski under our mattresses, and we're lying on that just in case the tent blew away. You know, because the ski had acted as a stop it from being blown away, but it was really terrible conditions, and we were lying there in our sleeping bags, fully clothed, and we didn't move outside the tent and we were talking back and to base, and of course they thought this was a big joke, you know. And we're only about 12 miles away from base, and conditions, we just lay there for 3 days, conditions were really bad.
Thought it was a joke.
Oh, they thought it was a fantastic joke, you know. And just laughing at other people's misfortunes, typically a British thing.
What did you do during those 4 days?
We just lay there. The first day it was just so bad, we just lay there. And then I was getting so bored that I started looking through the food boxes to see if there are any books there to read. And I found this book by Thomas Hardy, Jude the Obscure. I thought, it's going to be a really boring book. I didn't think it'd be exciting at all, but I picked it up and I started reading it, and it was a really powerful novel, you know. And I mean, I'd never have read it in any other situation, but it was a really powerful novel. And then the rest of the time we just lay there and slept and made cups of tea and whatever. Nothing much at all.
And the lights changing and the blizzard blowing.
Oh, there's very little light at all, you know, but the blizzard, it was just blowing all the time.
You've always wondered what the blizzard looks like.
Snow. Doesn't look like much at all. Usually at base, when there's a blizzard blowing, you just leave the dogs alone because they'd all get cuddled up in there and get a cocoon of snow. But once, for some stupid reason, I went up to see them to make sure they're all right. I think the blizzard had been on for about 3 or 4 days. And I got up to the dog span, and it was a really foul day. And I looked behind me, and there's one dog had managed to get loose, and she was following me along the span, and all the other dogs were trying to get to her. And then she and another dog started fighting, and I was trying to beat them to get them apart. And of course I looked down towards base to try and get someone to help, hoping someone would come up to help me, but of course no one saw me at all because the weather was just so bad, nobody was bothering coming out. And the job I had, I ended up getting my hands bitten. You know, getting these two dogs apart, and just this in this howling blizzard and terrible weather. It was quite frightening at the time, you know.
Turkish dogs always so edgy.
Possibly not. If it's like any other creatures, if you let them wander around loose, they establish a pecking order, you know, pecking order? Whoever's the top dog and so on and so forth. But the thing is, if we allow them to wander around loose, they would kill all the local population of penguins and seabirds and so on and so forth, or chicks. And also, there was... there are cliffs that could fall over. We wouldn't know where on earth they went to in the winter time, you know. You couldn't just let them wander around loose. It would be all right in a small island, perhaps, if they didn't. But you had to span them out to stop them, you know. And because they hadn't established their natural pecking order, they were always prone to fight each other. Yes, but once they'd been out in the field for a while and were exhausted or more tired, there wouldn't be any trouble from them then.
When you were at the base down there, you said in this first year you had a lot of spare time.
Oh, I had a lot of spare time in every year, but Argentine Islands was such an attractive base, it was an archipelago of islands, that it was possible to go out and just ski along the creeks. and do a lot of things there. I did some ice climbing there, ski along the creeks, etc. I don't think they always tried to have half and half, you know, half first year men, half second year men, and I don't think I didn't feel nearly so responsible in my first year as I felt in my second year. You know, you felt, you know, more responsible to get base going and to keep everybody happy and so on and so forth. And in my second year, I felt that a lot more.
Did you meet the Argentines or the Chileans when you were there?
When I first arrived on base, some Chileans came in on a plane to visit us, and we made them very welcome. Well, we all had a drink together, you know, and actually on the way. On the way south and on the way back north again, we stopped off at various bases, Esperanza, Presidente Frei, Hope Bay. You know, I can't remember if they were Argentinian or Chilean bases. You know, they spoke Spanish. And we went in for a drink and we talked with them, and they came onto the ship for a drink, and we got on very well with each other. They always made us very welcome. We talk with them at Christmas. Midwinter was June the 21st, the shortest day of the year, and we'd send greetings to all the other bases, you know.
Which was officially permitted.
Oh, nobody bothered about it. Don't know if it was officially permitted or not, we just did it. this is 73, it was long before the Falkland Islands conflicts and all that ballyhoo, so there's nothing said about it, you know?
Yeah, but I think there were always some irritations between the Argentinians, the Chileans and the Britons about land claims.
I think that's why they've all got their bases down there. They've all got this... They're all trying to claim these things, but that's politics and politics. I mean, politics you leave to the politicians, and the common men, the working men, are just quite happy to go out for a drink with each other. That's all they're worried about.
Yeah, uh-huh. But what did the man in Cambridge think about it?
I have no idea. No idea at all. They pronounced the official line and we accepted it, and then went for a drink with the Argentinians when we met them. You know?
Yeah.
That was it.
Wonderful. Yeah, makes sense. During winter, not during the summer.
I spent two winters there. I was down there summer and winter for 2 years. Mm-hmm.
How did you feel about this darkness?
Obviously, it wasn't something that just, boof, it was like that. It gradually crept up on you. Argentine Islands, we had the sun all winter. We're far enough north. At Adelaide, we didn't see the sun for 3 months or so, something like that, you know. But it was always a twilight in the middle of the day, a very short period, maybe 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the day. And you just got by, you just oriented your life. You mainly did things indoors.
Now, some people tell that during those winters, and they get sort of
morose.
No, a sleep disorder. That's because of the darkness. Some people tell just the opposite. And when in the summer, it is light all day.
Sometimes I couldn't get to sleep because it was so cold in the huts. You know, you had to put on extra socks and things like that. But really, I found no problems in it, with it at all, you know.
You managed to keep your rhythm.
I managed to keep my rhythm, If you couldn't get to sleep, you just got drunk and that got you to sleep, you know.
Did you have a weak rhythm over there?
A what?
A weak rhythm. I mean, is there a Saturday and a Sunday?
Oh, yes. Well, Saturday was the one day a week where you cleared up. everybody took their turn and you clean base. You give it a good cleaning out once a week. I mean, you cleaned it every day, but you know, Saturday was the extra special once a week cleaning. Also, Saturday night was the night when they had beer put out. Beer and spirits put out. And you had fresh meat on a Saturday as well. You know, it just made a highlight of the week. And then once a month, you got letters from home. You know, faxes, telexes. So that was always something to look forward to at the beginning of the month or whatever, you know.
At Sundays?
Hmm?
At Sundays?
Sundays. Sundays you usually had a hangover from Saturday. Yeah?
Is there any form of church or?
No.
No. Any Christians' feelings or so?
They're Christian feelings, Christian with a small c, you know, you got on well with other men. But there's no one really strongly religious. Yeah? That they wouldn't sit down and eat with an unbeliever or something like that, you know. I think they tended to choose people who had sort of moderate opinions so they'd get on well with other people. No one who was rabidly anti-smoking, or of course there wasn't the same fuss in those days about smoking as there is now, you know. Nobody who was rabidly teetotal or communist or anything like that, you know. They just got middle of the road moderate men, young men. Of course young men are more resilient than old men, you know, less set in their ways.
You mean that's the excuse really? Middle-of-the-road people, mellow people.
Mellow people, yes. Easy-going people.
Did you ever consider going to the South Pole? I mean...
The actual pole?
Yeah, the actual pole. Does it have an appeal for you?
Not the pole itself, no. I was just happy to be down there and working down there. I'd like to, you know, if somebody offered me a jolly to the South Pole, I'd take it, you know, but I wasn't particularly worried, you know.
It didn't have a symbolic value for you, like a lot of people want to stand on top of a mountain, and like that a lot of people want to go to a pole, like Scotland.
No, not particularly. I think there's a big American base there now and everything. No, it didn't particularly appeal to me, you know. And I'd like to have gone on longer sledging trips with the dogs, things like that, you know, but I enjoyed myself down there, I had a good time down there, so
what
why appeals, worry?
What appealed most to you?
The adventure. Doing something was out of the ordinary and just the adventure. That's what really appealed to me, something different.
Going to an Antarctic base?
Well, just something that was different, and I'd say adventure, you know, skiing, a bit of exploring, just seeing another part of the world I'd never seen before, because I'd hardly travelled, I'd been to Greenland. That's all I'd really been to before, just to see a different country and a part of the world that very few people have seen.
Could you compare Greenland to Antarctica?
No.
Could you make a difference between them?
Oh yes, Greenland's. Well, we were on the coast of Greenland, and it was a far softer climate. I mean, there were dwarf juniper bushes there. There were land-based mammals rather than just sea-based mammals such as seal. In the Antarctic, in Greenland, there were Arctic foxes, there were musk ox, things like that, reindeer.
Does one of the two appeal more to you?
Well, I saw more of the Antarctic, you know, so. And of course, there are no native people such as the Eskimos or the Inuit down in the Antarctic. The Antarctic's a bigger place, I saw more of it, so obviously it'd be more attractive to me.
Because there's more.
There's more of it, and I saw more of it, you know. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Is that it?
That's it.
Okay. Thank you.